think we could start taping, if you wish. I'm Ken Nagel. I'm a professor of international business at Concordia College in New York. I also have extensive corporate background. And I've run around the world for a number of decades. And the topic for today is business ethics in a diverse world. And a few jokes are appropriate. You know, Monday we had Vespers and we were talking about oxymorons, you know, honest politicians, business ethics, et cetera, virtual reality, constant variables. And we'll be looking at this from an international perspective for folks that need to do business around the world. And in the previous talk mentioned, you know, it's actually 31-32% of all goods and services that are produced and consumed across a national border. It's a phenomenal level. And we as Americans, we as our society are not producing nearly enough international managers to handle things. One of the key issues that international managers face is that of ethics, and I'd like to talk specifically on how managers face the challenges of corruption every day. Ethics is not easy. It's easy to say, in one way, you know, shooting somebody in the head, that's not good. Right? Ethical issues are seldom that clean, and we're going to look at a few. It is a truth that, the biblical truth that we live in a fallen world, and we certainly do. We also live in a wonderful world, a wonderful mosaic of cultures. Each has a distinct way of looking at the world, and pretty much from a different perspective than is our own. And an interesting quote on this comes from Pascal, 17th century philosopher and mathematician, which is an interesting combination. And he talks about the Pyrenees. The Pyrenees are the range of mountains that lie between France and Spain. And he said, there are truths, T-R-U-T-H-S, there are truths on this side of the Pyrenees that are falsehoods on the other. And it's a the 1600s, pretty good view. As any good instructor in cross-cultural communications will stress in working internationally, whether it's in the corporate world, whether it's in the diplomatic world, whether it's a not-for-profit, the NGOs, we need to be aware of our own biases, our own ethnocentrism, which we all have, all cultures have. And that is the ethnocentric. That is the tendency for managers to be parochial, to believe in the superiority of one's own group or culture, to think that the home country's way of doing things is better, and that home country managers are inherently more intelligent and effective than foreign local managers. This is a broad-based issue, and is not only reserved for Americans. Again, I probably will insult multiple people in my time up here, but the Germans are pretty good at that. The Japanese are pretty good at ethnocentric. The Swedes are pretty good at it too. Of course, not the Norwegians, but the Swedes. So what a global manager and a trained global manager seeks to avoid imposing one's own, his or her own sort of a cultural attitude and approaches on others. You try and get rid of your own filters and try and look at it from someone else's perspective. And the best global managers have developed an appreciation for diversity. And in a very pragmatic way, see cultural differences as a resource, not a limitation. And if you think of the history of the world where we used to kill each other fairly regularly, that's a hard skill to attain, but the best global managers have it. So it is not surprising that high value is placed on those managers that are well-traveled and are at ease in foreign environments. There's a very relevant quote from Mark Twain, and it was pretty pithy, and he said, "Catch the trade winds in your sails. Explore, dream, discover. Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. If you travel, you see other people. If you travel, you see other cultures. You're not getting it through hearsay. You're actually one-on-one with people. It's hard. It's hard to be prejudiced or biased if you know the person." You know, as Dan was saying earlier this morning, if you look somebody in the eyes, you are in a whole different place than saying those folks over there. And speaking of trade and travel, I thought I'd also throw in a Luther quote. Luther said, "I shall say nothing here about the pure pleasure a person gets from having studied. One can read all kinds of things, talk and associate with educated people, and travel and do business in foreign lands." What I tell my students, see, this is not so bad. But this kind of openness that Mark Twain talks about is a necessary foundation for global managers. But when it comes to operating commercially in the world, one also sees corruption in every society and on every continent. Maybe not Antarctica, but pretty much. In Africa, there is an impoverished country called Nigeria. Yes, Nigeria, a country that produces more oil each day than Kuwait. A country where 80% of the oil revenues go to just 1% of the population. There was a former dictator there, Sani Abachi. He did not loot tens of millions or hundreds of millions, but over 3 billion from that country. And this is a country in which the majority of Nigerians survive on less than a dollar a day. There is corruption everywhere. Previously, we had talked about China, and there's the term Guangxi, meaning at one level relationships, at one level connections, and another level, further level, influence. There in the legal system in China is a joke, and the international managers, the local Chinese, have little faith in the niceties of legal documents or contracts. And the reality is that without the correct guangxi, with high government officials, doing business is often problematic. And I'll use a diplomatic term. There was a report by the Stockholm School of Economics, and it noted that the cost of guangxi can double a firm's anticipated cost of doing business in China. Senior executive and friend had worked at JP Morgan, ran a big piece of Citigroup, told me that he had been conflicted, that he had been troubled because he'd been invited to address a conference of senior managers at the Bank of China. And he was conflicted because in his mind he would be talking to a room of corrupt and unethical managers. And there's truth. And there are huge problems within China. Now, just so we don't delude ourselves about our culture or any ethnocentric superiority, we don't have to go too far in our own society to hear about the malfeasance. And Jody talked about this the other day, the malfeasance within the Daley administration in Chicago, that apparently there's some penitentiary in Midwest that has a wing dedicated on a revolving reservation basis for political hacks out of the Daley administration. Or you can come close to us in New York, where Governor Rowland in Connecticut is doing federal time. Our own Governor Spitzer had to resign under, and he's under an investigation, and he may do time. And there's a city close to us in water called Waterbury, Connecticut, where in its history, with only one or two exceptions, every elected mayor of Waterbury has gone to jail. An interesting point in this connection is that Chinese mayors convicted of corruption don't necessarily do time. They may be sentenced to death. However, if they have enough guangxi, if they have enough juice, the sentence is not necessarily carried out. Justice is, again, the judicial system in China is not independent, and if you know somebody who knows somebody, you don't get a bullet in the head, you can get a reprieve. In fact, many of the rulings of the courts in China are just ignored. So, if corruption is part of our world, and it is, then we are then led to the question, how does one operate in that world? In getting things done overseas, you may have heard of the word bakshish.
Yes.
It's used in the Middle East. Or to use a more benign word, gratuity is asked for. In other countries, it's known as grease. In Nigeria, it's known as dash. In many countries, this is an everyday part of living. It's the norm. And if you're a government employee, it's an expected and understood part of your compensation. In India, there are almost standard rates for it. If you want a phone line to your house, you can have it next week. That is, if you pay the foreman 5,000 rupees. It's about 120 bucks, 118, 120 bucks. Or you can wait a year. Your choice. Okay. Also, after you pay your taxes in India, the municipal clerk is supposed to give you a voucher showing that you have paid your taxes. However, for that voucher, you need to give him or her a gratuity on top of your taxes. We love paying taxes. We'd love to pay something more. The thing is, if you don't pay for the gratuity for that voucher, that voucher will be lost somewhere in the massive Indian bureaucracy, and you'll be unable to prove you paid your taxes. You'll be in violation of law, and you can go to jail. So this is rather problematic. You don't want to go to jail. You also don't want to pay the bribe. A little aside here on international business. Interestingly, and this is a bit controversial, but there are times when you can legally pay gratuities to a foreign government official. Again, we're talking corruption here, which usually involves governments. And what the legal term for that is a facilitating payment, which is rather elegant. You may have heard of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The FCPA came into being in 1977. That was in response to an embarrassment, really, by the United States when Lockheed provided significant bribes to Japanese government officials, including the Prime Minister. The Act, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, was quite strict. Put constraints on American business, on American operations, and American business suffered because other countries weren't playing by those rules. So business was lost, employment was lost, and all those issues. And other countries, specifically France, was notorious for this, had no problem paying bribes. And if there was a large coal-burning energy plant that needed to be bid on and built overseas, and if it required a $20 million bribe, the French would pay the bribe, actually declare it to the French government. French government had no problem. Okay. So, what do you do? What do you do in a world where you're facing such things? Fortunately, today, everybody realized this wasn't right, and it was inequitable. And the business should go to the one with the better offering, the better proposal. And so hopefully, again, it's an ideal that it would go, things would be decided on the merits. So the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which is a group of the 33 largest trading countries in the world, got together and said, this isn't right, and we need to make rules that sort of go above national rules, because otherwise we'll just get into an ethical morass and start bidding up projects that really should not be. And a little further aside on this Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, that the important thing is the purpose of the payment. And it's not really targeting who receives the payment or the offer of the payment or the promise of the payment. What was the purpose of the payment? And one really isn't supposed to make facilitating payments, but the exception is that you can make them for what's called routine governmental action. And the statute lists several examples. One is obtaining permits, licenses or other official documents, processing governmental papers such as visas, work permits, police protection, mail pickup, and mail delivery, and providing phone service, power, water supply, loading and unloading cargo. That's a classic, where if you're shipping around the world and you don't make a low-level facilitating payment to the union boss, that 40-foot container will come nicely off the vessel, come to about 10 feet from the dock, and get dropped. Okay? Would you like that to happen, or would you like to make a small contribution? Also, protecting perishable products. How long would you like your cantaloupe or your lettuce to sit on the hot dock? 10 minutes or a week, right? After a week, it becomes non-saleable. Again, this is to a low-level area, and you can do it so long as it's low-level and that you're not gaining competitive advantage for it, and as long as the gratuity or facilitating payment is for a service that the foreign government, that is that foreign government's employee's job. You can pay them or give them a gratuity to do their job. You can't give them a gratuity to not do their job. You can't give them a gratuity to be mean to your competitors. So let's say I have a joint venture in Mexico, and that factory is rolling along. Piece of machinery breaks down, critical piece of machinery. They're going to shut the plant down, lay off two shifts. I've got to import critical spare parts into Mexico. Mexican government official, customs official, knows it's spare parts. I'm in trouble. Okay, what do? I pay that government official, not a lot of money, but some money, so that government official takes the rubber stamp, moves it from the desk, goes up in the air, comes down on my piece of paper, goes back and down. Now, I can pay that government, that's their job. I can pay that government official to do that today as opposed to it happening in a month. I got to plant this down. I got a couple hundred employees. And all the guy has to do is this. That is, of course, a gray area, but that is legal under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's also legal under OECD. Some would say that such payments show that one is adapting to a country's local norms and not showing an ethnocentric bias. And here we are, ugly Americans. We're not seeking to dictate through some form of cultural imperialism how another culture should operate. Others would say that not operating in the quote-unquote real world would simply be naive and would be what we would all be what Mark Twain in his book titled would all be innocents abroad. However, that's one way of looking at it. From my own corporate experience and knowing a lot of global managers, this has shown me that many managers make the point that in dealing with leaders in both industry and government, when the issue of effective leadership comes up, few qualities are mentioned with greater force or frequency than integrity. And it is the social cement between people, it is the social cement in the sort of leader-follower dynamic. When you make an investment in trust in someone, that's a leap of faith. And that's really where much of international business is. There's not a lot of trust in legal systems. We have a good one in the United States. But most times overseas, if you're doing business in another country, that other country's legal system will kill you if you ever enter into it. So business becomes between companies, becomes between individuals, not on paper, but trust and integrity between individuals. It's really where leadership meets reality. And most investors, company CEOs, and government officials, again, most are honest, place a premium on honesty and trustworthiness in making decisions on investments and partnerships. Global managers know enough to walk away from potentially lucrative deals when a sense of trust has not been developed. It sounds simple, but it's not. And if there is no trust or integrity, the success is going to be at best temporary and limited. Lasting success is built on repeated interaction and repeated business transactions. In business, you know, you don't want to sell anybody one Mars bar. You know, you want to sell them a Mars bar every other day. If you're in the B2B environment, you want to send them packaging, or you want to send them equipment this year, next year, the following year. And one tends to do business with those whom you trust and have had success with before. This should be obvious. It's not so obvious in reality. There is ever an expression, cheat me once, shame on me. Cheat me twice, and the entire industry will know about you. Okay. I've seen people roll around in Asia. I used to play there a lot. They would come into the market and do some business, screw the customer, take the money and run. They physically, for their own physical safety, they cannot go back. They cannot go back. Their company cannot go back and do business. And we're not talking sort of developing countries. We're talking Korea. We're talking Taiwan. So global managers, you know, from a not just because it's the right thing, but from a pragmatic point of view, have to strive to play straight with people. And that is a truth. It's also a truth that your credibility, if your credibility is in question, rebuilding it is almost impossible. And since you can't go back, you better get another line of work. Ethics and integrity go beyond adherence to local laws governing your industry and business. Ethics goes beyond borders and cultures and are aligned with a higher universal truth and good. Additionally, ethics should not be a risk-benefit calculation, adjusting the degree of compliance with the benefits or risks involved. Well, this is a really sweet deal. Might cross over into the gray area on this one. I've traveled, I've been really fortunate in my life, and I worked and traveled in over 60 countries. And I would submit that there is a remarkably universal code of ethics, a sense of right and wrong across cultures and across borders. And thinking back, bounces in my head, there's an explanation, Luther's explanation to the small catechism. And I think he got it right. When God created people, he wrote the law in their hearts. And at a fundamental level, all peoples recognize that graft and corruption are wrong. Okay, the real question is actually one of degree. What is the level of tolerance by a person or society for wrongdoing? So an official who's shaking you down in India, or official who's shaking you down, or government official in Kenya, they know it's wrong. They know it's wrong. So when an American manager seeks to act with integrity, again, this may be oxymoronic, but when an American manager seeks to act with integrity, I dismiss the notion that he or she is an agent of Western cultural imperialism trying to impose his or her own version of ethics. Now this is warm and fuzzy. This is nice and laudable, nice philosophy, but is it real world? Does the world operate this way? Does business operate this way? Can you be successful in national trade operating this way? And in an often corrupt world, can a business act ethically and prosper? Or from a more, I'll say it nasty here, from a more liberal perspective, are businesses in market economies even capable of acting ethically? That's a big question. Not always, obviously. But the answer to these questions is yes, and it can be a real world yes. An example, a friend was the European director of a major pharmaceutical company, it's Pfizer, and his personal friend, and he was based in Brussels. And those that are involved in global trade know that Belgium, again, nice, European, sophisticated, educated, right? Brussels, home of the Eurocrats. You know, the European Union, all those folks. However, in business, in global trade, Belgium is sometimes referred to in business circles as the Sicily of the North. And this is not a term of endearment. My friend's company was importing Lipitor, the cholesterol lowering medication. And the shipments were being held up in customs in this nice European-friendly country that makes chocolate and great beer. But the customs officials were looking to shake down the company. And Dieter, my friend, he said, no, we're not going to pay you. And they said, well, your stuff is not going to cross our border. Well, Dieter's a tough guy, and he went to the Ministry of the Interior, and he went to the Ministry of Finance, ministerial level. And they listened, and they smiled, And they said, we're sure you can work this out. And they didn't do anything. So Dieter didn't pay, okay? And he also stopped shipments of Lipitor into Belgium. Doctors and hospitals began to notice, and there was this groundswell of what is going on. The medical community was agitated, and the press picked up on it, and that shamed the government ministries into clearing the shipments. Now, this is an ethical call, and it's not the ethical call that is the road of least resistance. This was not easy to do, and it was not the call of, well, let's just get along. And so it hurt Pfizer in the short term because of this. But today, Belgian customs officials know better than to try and shake down that company again. And they have not tried it again. So the lesson is that when one's position is clear, that when me and my company, bit of a biblical paraphrase, but when me and my company, competition and collusion are not common practice, then it just won't be attempted. And that is generally true. If people can push you to a place you don't want to be, and you get pushed, they'll do it again. Another example, widely reported in the press, is the systemic corruption in the former communist states in Eastern Europe and Russia. Amazing level of corruption. The creation of the term oligarch. There are more billionaires being produced in Russia than anywhere else. And it's interesting, just as an aside, again, I don't like lawyers. There's a friend, Jerry Dobley's in the, I wish he was here, I could insult him personally.
Left yesterday.
Left yesterday. Well, maybe we'll come back to that. But one of the strengths of America is its legal system. And so, and the Brits too. And so where did the oligarchs park their money? Where do the oligarchs buy their real estate? They buy their real estate in New York and London. They invest in the New York Stock Exchange. They invest in the London Exchange. Why? Because there's legal underpinnings, there's an ethical underpinnings to those markets, to property values and contracts. If they left their money in Russia, they have no assurance that Putin et al. Will just someday come and get it. Just a little bit of interesting aside.
You know, I have some personal experience in Eastern Europe, and the thing that I wonder is there some relationship, I mean, there must be some relationship between the health of the government and the degree of corruption. And because in Moldova, where I was, they're literally, I mean, people, even doctors and school teachers and things like that, I mean, the whole system was so fouled up that's the way people actually made a living.
Yes. The stronger the government, not in terms of the iron fist, but the more competent the government, the more transparent the government, the more that there is a support on the legitimacy of that government, that cause and effect, there is less corruption. One of the most corrupt, it's a small country, Albania, in Europe. Its criminals are running a country. It's like Noriega. Criminals are actually running Albania. Just some interesting statistics about America in the world. And this is the number of lawyers per 100,000 people, okay? We have 290 lawyers per 100,000 people. We are a arguably the most litigious country that ever was. And it is a reflection of what sociologists call high context or low context. A high context culture is, it's as important what is not said as what is said, what is understood, as versus what is explicit. And we are very low context. Culture is not in our nature. And we have a, for better or worse, a spirit of confrontational competitiveness. We compete like hell with each other. So the United States has 290, it's a lot of lawyers, per 100,000 population. United Kingdom, you know, which 1066, ballot Hastings, Magna Carta, all that kind of stuff, the mother of parliaments, they have less than half the number we do. They have 141 lawyers per 100,000. The French have 80. Germans have 79. But this kind of begs a question, you know, how unjust is the English legal system? I'd be comfortable in the legal system in the UK. I really would. Anyway, moving from low context cultures, sort of European cultures, to very high context cultures where there are clear legal systems, you can move to Japan, where it is a country the exact opposite of confrontation. It's absolutely, you failed, you lose, somebody's gonna lose face if there's confrontation. America, we don't care if we lose face. We lose. We'll fight again another day. If you lose in Japan, you're done. You've lost face, your career is over. So in Japan, there are 11 lawyers per 100,000 people compared to 290 here. Okay. In South Korea, which is an amazing economic phenomenon, where they as a society said, you know, we were so devastated by the Korean War and communism and the Chinese coming down from the north, and Seoul, the capital, you know, was absolutely leveled. We're just going to get along. And for every 100,000 people in Korea, there are 3 lawyers. Okay. Obama says we should probably produce fewer lawyers and more engineers as a society. He's probably right. Anyway, I love those numbers.
Do they reflect the level of corruption in those particular communities? I think Korea,
no,
Japan.
Japan is not. Well, regularly, the presidents of those countries do get arrested, but it's part of their culture to help your friends. I can talk more on that later. That's a very good question. I'd like to give an example from, and this has to do with the value of ethics, and ethics being seen as honest, leading to success. And from my own corporate experience, I was part of an extended, painful negotiation in Israel with a major company there called Tanuva. Israelis are tough. I got beaten up pretty good, but the negotiations were successful, and they were successful in part because we developed a sense of trust, if not friendship. I have great Israeli friends. These weren't friends, but we trusted each other. And I think the reason was, and I'm sure the reason was, is that I was seen not as the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I was seen as a straight play. Okay? And after the agreement, my opposite number took me aside, he looked me in the eye, and he said, he wasn't calling me stupid, by the way, I don't qualify it. He wasn't calling me stupid. But he said, "Kit, stay who you are. Don't ever become clever. Okay. You don't do business with people who are clever." And this goes back to the early point that lasting success is built on repeated interaction with those whom one trusts. I'd also like to note that with all its failings, an ethical approach is not unique, and most corporations, and I'll use the example of PepsiCo, which is just up the road from us in Bronxville, New York. We have a good relationship with them as with our international management program, has a very strict code of ethics to conduct their dealings around the world. And I'm pleased that one of the their senior managers is involved with our international management program. And he talked about how the double standards don't work. For in addition to ethical behavior simply being the right thing to do, I mean, it is conceivable that people, a few people in business might have ethics. I mean, grant possible. Right? The downside exposure of wrongdoing can have devastating PR implications. The code of ethics can drive managers to make tough choices locally, even to the detriment of business, and even put you at a competitive disadvantage when competitors behave in an unethical way, but a locally acceptable way. And while it can make a manager's life harder in the short term, over time, their experience is that sound business principles and ethics do pay out. So it's not just the right thing to do at the bottom line, at the end of the day, at the end of the decade, will be the better for it. I'd like to go back to Russia again, in Eastern Europe, and there, this was Dieter Vinen at Pfizer, making not just all their employees, but their vendors and licensees sign and adhere to a code of ethics. And the Central Europeans and the Russian managers, they didn't believe it. They said, this is window dressing. And he wasn't taken seriously, and Dieter's somewhat German, so he somewhat has a serious backbone. And he cleaned house. He fired senior people. He fired the company director for Central Europe. This is no minor functionary. He fired the company director for Russia, and I wish W was here, but he also fired the in-house general counsel. Was this easy? Of course it wasn't easy. Did it disrupt business, hurt business? Yes, it certainly did. But in the short term, and he believes that being known for an ethical approach to business is a long-term competitive advantage, not a disadvantage. We also don't need to be boorish or insensitive in dealing internationally. And in some countries, for example, like Saudi or Egypt, gift giving is very important. It's part of the social fabric. It's part of a negotiation. And refusing a gift can and is offensive. If someone's going to give me a gift and I don't take it, we're done. Okay. So am I taking a bribe? Is that a facilitating payment? And a creative solution that corporations have come up with is to be gracious, to accept that gift, okay, report it to your employer, and then auction it off at a charity event. Okay. Again, these senior managers see ethical compromise as a slippery slope. So, now more than ever, again, my world is doing my best to teach the next generation of international managers. We don't make near enough of them. And they need to be competent. And they need to have a highly practical understanding of how trade works, including, and yes, understanding of how corruption works. So it can, terrible to quote me out of context, but at Concordia College, New York, we teach how corruption works.
Forewarned is forearmed.
Forewarned is forearmed. But we're teach to clearly not tolerate or promote it. Ethical behavior must come as a basic conviction, a principle, and if it is governed by an inner sense of right and wrong, a sense of fairness and human compassion, it will guide my students, it will guide them when they're managers, not as only as a way of doing business, but as a way of life. And I'll close, and if there's comments or thoughts that you want to talk about Enron, we can talk about Enron. But as a global manager, I respect says to each of his employees, everything in life is temporary except two things, your integrity and your family. You jeopardize either by unethical behavior and you will never get them back. And that is also the truth. So we've sort of run our course. I've given a view that's not a universal view about business. Business falls down all the time. There's Enron, World Crossing, et cetera. But not everybody out there is just without integrity.
Okay, getting back to China.
Yeah.
You know, you go over there and everything's a knockoff. Doesn't matter. They don't have any copyright laws. They don't have any patents. They don't believe in any of that stuff. How does Walmart operate with those kinds of people?
Well, it's a great question. Walmart operates very well with those people. that's birds of a feather for Walmart. An interesting thing just about China. China is making efforts to develop a marketing expertise. Americans are brilliant at marketing. We're good at managing. We can market stuff. We can brand stuff. And the Chinese from time to time, will try and develop a branded Chinese product. And they've come up and they've made some good sneakers and some good basketball shoes and stuff. And they have their own logo on it. It's not the swoosh, but their own logo on it. And it's interesting that the Chinese themselves would rather purchase a fake Nike knockoff or a fake Dior than an actual real Chinese product. So culturally they don't have a problem. I'm speaking way too broadly here because it is maturing, and there are laws and conventions that they are following. But they don't come from a place where that strange Western construct of copyright is part and parcel of the culture.
In terms of corruption, is there any difference between Northern China and Southern China? You made some comment about the emperor's far away, speaking about the people in Southern China.
There is a difference. In Southern China, I cannot speak broadly. It's too big a place. But in Shanghai, there's more of a global business sense of adhering to agreements than is necessarily there in other parts of China. And this goes back to the days when there was, again, going back to the talk on Monday, when there was a Republic of China that was open to the world, and a very substantial, large middle class developed that was open to the West, that was often Western educated, and understood sort of Japanese or Western way of doing business. So it, and as I mentioned Monday, nearly, well, many, many, the majority of people who were educated, who were in business, who were entrepreneurs, who were engineers, they decamped, they left China, because China was, you know, the curtain, the bamboo curtain was coming down. That's a PhD type question. That's a very hard question.
I guess I also see there's some difference if you're a small company and you're trying to move something across the dock, where if there's a lot of, you're in an area where there's tons and tons of competition, paying small fees and things like that. I think the thing that's really troubles me is that there are really large companies that have a unique product. Like Pepsi is a great example, you know, and it seems like there's only one Pepsi, right? And the thing I think it troubles me in terms of oil is there's only three or four oil companies that would have the even the wherewithal to actually develop oil in Africa. And it seems like that's where government has to really be strong. And it seems like that's a whole different animal when you're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars being paid out as bribes.
Yeah, and I think there is a good point that the more that one's product is a commodity, the more fungible it is, the more one is pressured, you know, for bribes and corruption. The more unique, the more distinct one's product is, like Lipitor, I won't say it's easy, because what he did was hard, but it's easier to take an ethical, you know, to ethical stance that would stick.
I guess what I'm suggesting is I think that the solution for corruption at that level has got to be international and it's got to be governmental. It's hard to imagine that Africa is going to solve, or that Nigeria will solve that problem.
That's a great question. It's a great rhetorical question too, and you run into other issues of sovereignty. You know, we're a sovereign country. You can't tell us how to run what's in our borders, and it's complicated and it's nuanced. It's also I mentioned some problems in Africa, but there's a tremendous amount of corruption in Africa, and this used to be blamed upon, well, it was from, you know, the colonial legacy. And there's now, you know, that played well, and there was a lot of truth to it, that played well for a while. But the current generation of folk say, well, you know, we've been riding that horse for a while. And there's a great book by a Guyanese, Ayete, called China Unchained, and he goes around Africa and shows the corruption that's endemic, and it's not getting blamed on, you know, 50 year ago colonial experience, and much of Africa is improving, and yet tremendously problematic is, you know, the sub-Sahara areas, and sort of a segue, but we'll be talking about that Saturday, but that's Nigeria's an awful mess. It was terrible. Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's something that's under this when we try and think of what constitutes integrity and what constitutes corruption. Because when you give those figures, for example, about attorneys, I don't think that necessarily shows that we're less corrupt. I think it's that we have a tendency to, as you said, to litigate. And is that impulse to sue each other and to lodge responsibility through the legal system, isn't that a kind of corruption of responsibilities? I mean, instead of taking personal or corporate responsibility, we always want to put it on somebody else. I'm not sure that that's something to hold up. I don't know that there's another system that you want to just replace it with, but the sense in some countries that you're responsible for yourself seems admirable to me, in contrast to our inclination to always want somebody else to be responsible for everything bad that happens to us. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what are the variables underneath the systems. And that high context, low context is one way of getting at it, but is there some other way that we can think about what the variables are?
There can be. There's something that's kind of interesting, speak about responsibility for one's actions. And this is not really, this is coming back in a strange way on this. But a friend, Daniel Chow, who was at the UN and for 27 years at the Secretariat, was born in Shanghai, and then was part of the exodus to Taipei and Taiwan, and then Western educated and worked at the United Nations. And he regularly goes back to China to lecture on international institutions, how the world works, and how other societies, non-Chinese societies, work. And his students frequently, and he's really surprised at it, but his students frequently talk about, well, in America or the West, you know, it's a free society, because in China, you do what you're told.
Yeah.
Your life, again, with the exception of the wealthy folk, your life is pretty much prescribed. And so when they ask, when you come to America, you have all this freedom, so you can do whatever you want. You can go to a restaurant and, you know, be loud and boisterous and whatever. And Daniel Chow says, yes, there's freedom in America, but there, the balance to that is responsibility. And it's kind of a harsh comment, but because everything in your life, or much of your life, is established and you're told what you do in China, you don't have to be responsible. But you come to where there is freedom, the price of freedom is responsibility.
Kid, another possibility, just following up on Deanne's point. When Bill Bradley was running for president, he used to quote social scientists and say, you know, if you have a good society, you can tell, because it's like a three-legged stool. You've got a strong public sector, a government that works and is responsive. You've got a strong market, private sector that works, that's creative. And you've got a third leg of the stool called civil society, not the market and not the state. And it's all these other come in. That includes church, it includes, you know, all of the sort of social networks and norms and so forth. And a lot of ethics, it seems to me, lies in civil society, not in the state or in the market. And the ethical behavior that we are growing up with gets imbued in us through our relationships and through our extended kinship. And I think when I go to developing countries, I see a lot of wonderfully ethical, caring, responsible behavior at the local level, where the norms of civil society are taking place, but not necessarily up here where it's the state versus the market. And the problem in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe is that they squashed civil society. So there's just the state, and now they're trying to introduce the market.
Yeah.
And that's a ball game that doesn't have the sort of mediating structure of civil society where we live and have norms with each other.
Yeah.
Right.
No, that's very
and
good.
Also, if you read the kind of comparative cultural anthropology that people are going to try and understand the world that the Bible comes out of, and the difference between a collectivist society and an individualist society, I think that's part of what's hard for Americans when we go to countries where there is that sort of collectivist view. So that if you giving presents is really important because it builds the relationship. And we have laws instead of relationships, right? And the laws prohibit us from participating in the ritualized behaviors that are supposed to build relationships. Now, I'm not suggesting that we just say, you know, that I go to my friend John Martin's big on legislative ethics and say, John, I think you're crazy. We shouldn't have these laws about legislators accepting gifts from lobbyists. It's not, I'm not saying that, but I do think it helps us understand what's going on in other places where if where losing face is what keeps you on the path instead of fear of being sued. Why would I have a fence around an attractive hazard in my yard? Well, otherwise I'll get sued. Well, or maybe I put a fence around the attractive hazard because I don't want the neighborhood children to be harmed altruistically, or I do it because I don't want them to be harmed because then I'll lose face. In any case, somebody should put up a fence. So it's a matter of how you get there.
Just to circle around with, I agree. What Jody pointed, in Africa, in numerous countries, you know, why is agriculture failing? It's because usually what happens at the farmer's level is rational. What happens, the farther away you get from the actual farmer, becomes irrational. And so, you know, there would be an agricultural board that would take all production and then sell it. And if it were a cash crop or to be sold overseas, who's going to get the money from that? Who's going to get the profit from that? It's not the farmer.
Right.
It's not the farmer. If we had more time, I got a great story about Russia, but we're out of time. And
thank you.